Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Susan Yawkey reporting. Iran vows divine vengeance on Saudi Arabia for its execution of Shiite cleric. Iran's supreme leader said today that Saudi Arabia will face divine vengeance for its execution of Sheikh Namer al-Namer, a prominent Shiite cleric of Saudi Arabia's ruling royal family. Iranian state television quoted Ayatollah Ali Khamenei as saying, "The unjustly spilled blood of this oppressed martyr will no doubt soon show its effect, and divine vengeance will befall Saudi politicians." Angry Iranian protesters stormed the Saudi embassy in Tehran and a consulate in Mashhad, smashing furniture and setting fires at the embassy in the Iranian capital before being ejected by police. At least 40 protesters were arrested. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani called the attacks on the diplomatic missions totally unjustifiable, even as he denounced Riyadh's execution of the 56-year-old Shiite cleric. In India, Shiite Muslims marched through Srinagar, voicing their opposition to the numerous executions, especially the killing of Namer. Sayed Mujahid was among the protesters in Srinagar.
"We are protesting for the martyrdom of the Ayatollah Sheikh Bakr Namer in Saudi Arabia, along with 42 Mu'minin who are executed today. So we condemn this execution with strong words."
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said he was deeply dismayed by the execution of Namer and the 46 other people and called for calm and restraint. The U.S. warned that Namer's death would only add to strife between religious sects in the region. This is VOA News. Indian security forces battled for a second day to secure an airbase that came under attack by unidentified gunmen on Saturday in the northern town of Pathankot, about 50 kilometers from the border with Pakistan. Officials say soldiers noticed the presence of two terrorists in a wooded area as combing operations were being carried out today to secure the base in Punjab State. Soon after, the sound of explosions and gunfire rang out as soldiers mounted an operation to capture them. Four gunmen were killed on Saturday. The raid claimed a total of 11 lives, including seven Indian security personnel. 12 others have been injured. The airbase houses dozens of fighter aircraft. The Obama administration says it needs more time before it can move to impose new sanctions on Iran over its ballistic missile program. Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes said the additional work the U.S. is undertaking is not based on pushback from Iran. An Israeli court has indicted two Jewish militants for an arson attack on a Palestinian home last July that killed a toddler and his parents. The assailants allegedly threw firebombs into the West Bank home as the family slept. Robert Berger reports from Jerusalem.
Hussein Dawabsha, the grandfather of the slain Palestinian toddler, says the indictment is a step in the right direction. Dawabsha told Israel Radio he is happy that two of the perpetrators were indicted and he is hoping for additional arrests. The question is whether the indictments will ease tensions on the ground. The arson incident is widely seen as a catalyst for a wave of almost daily Palestinian attacks on Israelis over the past 4 months that has shown no sign of letting up. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
U.S. President Barack Obama has declared an emergency in the flood-ravaged state of Missouri as major floodwaters move south. Saturday's move allows federal aid to help the state recover from massive flooding that has killed at least two dozen people, forced thousands of others to evacuate, and submerged huge swaths of farmland. Obama's declaration also permits the Federal Emergency Management Agency to coordinate disaster relief. And President Obama is heading back to Washington from his holiday vacation, looking immediately to impose new controls on gun sales. Obama, his wife Michelle, and their two daughters departed the U.S. Pacific state of Hawaii late Saturday night after their annual two-week Christmas vacation on the president's birthplace island. Obama is entering the last year of his presidency, set to leave office in January of 2017 after 8 years in the White House. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
With roughly two-thirds of the votes counted in Bangui, the capital, Faustin Touadéra, a former prime minister in the government of ousted President François Bozizé, leads with 31,000 votes.
The Central African Republic releases first batch of the provisional results of the presidential and parliamentary polls.
The problem with voters' register is that it's not static, but there was argument that there were minors on the register. There were aliens registered.
The Ghanaian Electoral Commission says it will not compile a new voter list to be used for this year's general election, despite calls by the main opposition party to do so.
Je voudrais saluer de manière spéciale la décision des États-Unis d'Amérique.
He says he specially thanks the U.S. government for sending troops to assist Cameroon's military.
And Cameroonian President Paul Biya welcomes the engagement of U.S. troops in the fight against Boko Haram militants. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. First results have been announced in the Central African Republic's December 30 presidential and legislative elections. Two candidates have enough support to advance to a second round of the presidential race, while the ballot counting continues. For VOA, Katrina Hoye reports.
Yerikata Gaston Mandata, 1131.
With roughly two-thirds of the votes counted in Bangui, the capital, Faustin Touadéra, a former prime minister in the government of ousted President François Bozizé, leads with 31,000 votes, just ahead of Anicet Dologele, also a former prime minister, with 28,000 votes. As the results were announced Saturday, Touadéra's supporters, such as campaign staffer Rosalie Emmanuel, gathered outside the candidate's campaign headquarters.
Le premier tour, c'est du chaos. C'est un homme intègre.
The first round is for Touadéra. It's a knockout. Touadéra is a man with integrity. He's a unifier. The president needs his. Results from the provinces and the diaspora are pending. Ballots from South Africans voting in Morocco and neighboring Congo-Brazzaville arrived at the Electoral Commission Saturday. Votes from the provinces are expected in coming days. The head of an African Union observer mission, Suleiman Ndiaye, said the elections were peaceful and transparent and that observers did not notice any irregularities or any fraud in the sense that anyone opened ballot boxes and threw in extra ballots. In that sense, he said the elections were free and fair, but that there were some logistical difficulties. Two-thirds of the polling stations the AU observers visited opened late. Some stations did not get any ballots for the legislative elections. Others ran out of ballots for the presidential election. Residents who had not received their voters' cards were allowed to cast ballots if they could present a valid ID card or a seat for the voter card. Elections have been postponed three times due to logistical difficulties. The Central African Republic has been rocked by violence since March 2013 when a largely Muslim alliance of rebel groups overthrew President François Bozizé. The rebel leader left power in 2014, and sectarian violence between the anti-Balaka militia and Seleka rebels has continued, killing thousands and displacing nearly 1 million people. Katrina Hoye for VOA News, Bangui.
The Electoral Commission of Ghana has decided not to compile a new voter list to be used for this year's general election, despite calls by the main opposition New Patriotic Party to do so. The call prompted the Electoral Commission to form an independent panel to look into the concerns of the opposition. But the chairman of the independent panel, Professor VCRAC Crabb, told me members of the committee came to the conclusion that arguments for a new register were unconvincing, and that's why they did not recommend the replacement of the current voter register.
A political party misstating allegations about the voters register. The problem with voters register is that it's not static. But there was argument that there were minors on the register. there were aliens on the register. So as a panel, we had to go into the problems of minors getting on the register and aliens getting on the register. These considerations were uppermost in our minds. You have to appreciate that we have a problem of ethnic communities which cut across our borders. And we have to take such things into consideration.
Before your commission was established, a lot of accusations and counter-accusations were made in the media concerning proof that some political parties said they had of what they caused the bloating of the electoral register that will be used for this year's general election. Now, after considering these evidences or proof that they have, what was the conclusion and the recommendation of your committee to the EC?
Well, you see, those allegations of bloating, when we held the forum, there were other people who came to establish that the registers were not bloated. Consider the changes and the challenges which face the electoral commission, and therefore see how far you could make recommendations to the commission so that all these allegations can be dealt with. Where there is proof, what has got to be done, and we make recommendations in respect of that.
What were some of the recommendations your committee made after looking at all these issues that you have to deal with?
I knew this question was coming with some of the accusations. As I indicated earlier, is that one of the conditions on which you can be registered as a person to vote in this country, if you are 18 years and over, and of sound mind, of course, is that you are a citizen of the country. Citizenship of this country has been a very, very thorny issue. And anybody who claims that somebody is on the register and shouldn't be on the register must establish that that person is not a citizen of Ghana. And this is where there was a problem that was never established, that those persons who are supposed to be aliens and whose names are on the register are in fact not citizens of Ghana. This is where the problem is. And I believe in the report we went into a little bit of the legal framework. There are one or two cases in this country in which people's citizenship had been challenged, and it was very difficult to prove.
Were your members unanimous in these recommendations that you presented to the EC?
We never disagreed on anything.
What will be your message to the people of Ghana based on the deliberations that you and your team made about this voter register?
My message to Ghanaians would be to have a clean register in this country is a shared responsibility.
Professor V.C. R.A.C. Crabb is the chairman of the independent panel formed by the Electoral Commission of Ghana. He spoke with me from the capital, Accra. Tanzania President John Magufuli's newly appointed permanent secretaries have signed a beefed-up integrity commitment document as part of a move to ensure seriousness towards rooting out graft and injecting accountability among public sector workers, according to government spokesman Asa Mwambini. This is the first time that newly appointed government officials have signed this document in public. Mwambini told me the newly appointed officials were then made to read the signed document one after another at the State House in the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. President Magufuli was on hand to supervise the signing.
This is a manifestation of the seriousness in terms of ensuring that every public official to a level of a permanent secretary must have unquestionable personal integrity. Traditionally, in Tanzania, we have the Ethics Commission that every appointed public leader, I do sign the same document every year, but this time around, it has been beefed up with a very serious corruption element, issue of personal integrity itself, transparency, and just ensuring that when you are in power, you will really work to the law, but also observe ethical standards, make sure that you are not at any time being related or suspected to be involved in malpractice or being corrupt.
Talking about the president's seriousness to integrity and fighting corruption, is there any mechanism apart from this commitment document that these officials signed that will ensure that public officials work to the benefit of the ordinary Tanzanian and ensure that corruption is rooted out?
Initially, these people were signing the same document all the time, but you normally sign not in public and not before the president. So this is the document you are is sent to you, you write and send it to the Ethics Commission. But this time around, the president wanted to be there at the State House. He did something very, possibly very unusual to Tanzania. He went to the podium and said, this is a very serious assignment, a very serious commitment. If there is anyone who thinks that at one point in time he will not abide to these guidelines, please say it now so that you should be exonerated when it comes to, you know, taking action when you are suspected to be involved into any of the issue that has been mentioned.
Talking about public sector workers, will this also go to them?
Well, you must be aware that we have now, the members of the business community who have also signed document, of course, voluntarily, and this is an issue that the president is himself and the government is really taking seriously to ensure that even on the side of the private sector, that anybody who, you know, signed that document, I understand the chairman of the Tanzania National Business Council, Mr. Ali Mfuruki, is one of the few members who have signed this document to ensure that they will also ride around the government effort. So they are seeing to it that this is a good process that will help possibly harness and you know, eliminate corrupt element in the public sector, in both public and private sector.
What should Tanzanians expect under President John Magufuli's leadership about rooting out corruption, about improving the living conditions of Tanzanians in this new year?
Well, what I see is that people expect the Magufuli administration to be marked by people must work. People must not only seem to be working, but they really must work, because if you don't, definitely you will not get a place in this government. The second aspect is, seriously, he is very serious about rooting out corrupt element in government, both in private and public sector. And, you know, he has also shown that by also seeing to the Tanzania Revenue Authority now, the normal collection per month was about 9 billion Tanzania shillings before the president came into power. Immediately, the very month that the president came into power, it crossed 1.3 trillion collection per month, which is extraordinary and has never happened. So we should expect also that all calls for tax evaders will definitely be wiped out, because the scenario is that we have too much money around that people are messing up with it through these corrupt elements, through malpractice. So with the seriousness into collecting taxes and plugging off loopholes for tax evaders.
Asa Mwambene is the spokesman for the Tanzanian government. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. Cameroon President Paul Biya welcomed the engagement of U.S. troops in his country's fight against Boko Haram insurgents, but many Cameroonians do not yet understand the role of the troops in the war. For VOA reporter Moki Edward Kenzeka spoke with Cameroonians, regional troop commanders, and the U.S. military commanders on the activities in Cameroon.
Cameroon President Paul Biya, in his end-of-year message, said Boko Haram had remained a major challenge to his country's development, peace and security, and saluted what he called the experience and expertise of American troops in helping Cameroon.
Je voudrais saluer de manière spéciale la décision des États-Unis d'Amérique.
He says he specially thanks the U.S. government for sending troops to assist Cameroon's military to free his country from Boko Haram. He says he is highly delighted with the confidence of the American people, especially now that their troops have been providing vital information and training for his country's military. 30-year-old Muslim youth leader Buba Ahijo says residents of Cameroon's northern town of Garoua were told U.S. troops had come to liberate them from Boko Haram atrocities. But he says he is still not aware what the Americans have been doing more than 2 months after they arrived.
Alors, je ne sais vraiment pas ce qui se passe.
He says he expected the U.S. forces to fight alongside Cameroonian soldiers to defeat Boko Haram, but they have instead stayed in their offices since they came. He questions why the Americans have not attacked Boko Haram as he hears they attacked an Islamic State base in Iraq. Cameroon has been fighting a Boko Haram insurgency that spilled over into its territory from Nigeria 3 years ago. According to the United Nations, more than 20,000 people have lost their lives and more than 2 million people have been displaced. The head of the Marines contingent, Colonel Mike Davis, described the type of support the United States is giving the Cameroon Army in the fight against Boko Haram.
Cameroonian government asked the United States government to support them in their fight against Boko Haram. So what we are doing is assisting the Cameroonian government in their fight against Boko Haram. That support is in the way of a remotely piloted aircraft, among other things, training, some security stuff.
Cameroon Army General Jonkep Mihomi Frederick, one of the top commanders of Cameroon troops fighting the Boko Haram insurgency, says the assistance they are receiving from the Americans is basically training and intelligence sharing.
La nature de leur contribution est liée aux capteurs qu'ils ont. C'est des drones de très bonne génération.
He says the U.S. troops have excellent and up-to-date drones that give them vital and timely information, and then they surgically intervene against the terrorists wherever an attack is taking place or is being planned. He says the Americans have been fully cooperating in surveillance and information sharing, which is very vital in the war against the terrorists. Cameroon military spokesman Colonel Didier Bajek says people should not expect U.S. soldiers at the battlefront, but that they are very instrumental in Cameroon's recent successes against the insurgents.
Ils sont ici exclusivement pour aider les Camerounais qui font très bien leur guerre.
He says American soldiers are in Cameroon exclusively to help eliminate Boko Haram with their advanced technology, and that from the month of February 2016, they will be fully operational when the rest of the remaining contingent arrives in Cameroon to make up the 300 promised by President Barack Obama. In December, Cameroon announced its soldiers and Nigeria's military had liberated more than 900 people from Boko Haram strongholds. Government officials said they benefited from the U.S. technical expertise. The U.S. military is setting up its first drone base in Africa, and Cameroon believes it is likely to host it. Soldiers of the Central African nation are learning how to use drones for surveillance from the U.S. Marines. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Guinea and Sierra Leone have been declared Ebola-free, while Liberia is expected to follow in mid-January. Experts say healthcare systems need to be rebuilt and safe practices maintained in order to prevent future outbreaks. And this report, written by VOA's William Eagle, Odette Frazier, has more on the legacy of the outbreak and the lessons learned.
The outbreak touched many parts of society in the three countries stricken by the virus. Economies declined as quarantines affected cross-border trade, while unsteady healthcare systems collapsed. The disease, which started in March 2014, killed over 11,000 people and infected over 28,000. UNICEF says children have been particularly affected. It says 22,000 children in Sierra Leone, Guinea, and Liberia have lost one or both parents. Children also missed vaccinations, and several million between ages 3 and 17 missed from 6 to 9 months of school. Parents stopped registering their children at healthcare centres, which many considered to be contagious. Patrick Moser is a spokesman with UNICEF in New York.
A child who is not registered does not exist in an administrative sense. So they're more vulnerable to exclusion, very difficult to obtain identity documents, to have access to basic health and social services, and even greater danger of being trafficked or illegally adopted.
UNICEF says the outbreak reinforced the need for educating rural people on simple methods for stopping the spread of the virus. But this was complicated by rumors and misinformation. Some said the outbreak was created by the West and healthcare workers were there to kill people or force them into trafficking. Dr. Mohamed Ayoya is UNICEF's representative in Guinea. He told VOA in an email that at the beginning of the outbreak, people told him that the treatment centers were really extermination camps, and once you agree to go there, you'll never come out. To many, he said, treatment centres were places where shady tests were conducted, where people were used as guinea pigs to carry on various experiments and then killed to get their organs. Dr. Ayoya said most thought that spraying their houses with chlorine water, which was used by the Red Cross, was actually a way of spreading the disease. UNICEF countered with efforts of its own. Patrick Moser says that in Sierra Leone, sirens and ambulances scared people and fueled rumors that bodies were being stolen. So the sirens were removed and the community members and leaders were invited to ride in the vehicles.
And they would come out and tell the rest of the community, look, I came back, I'm alive, I didn't die in the ambulance, it is safe. Little things like that made a huge difference.
In a similar case, he said, one young farmer was helping to build roadblocks to keep healthcare workers out of the community. He said the responders were forcing people into slavery and selling body parts.
So one day his niece, 15-year-old niece, got Ebola, was taken to Ebola treatment center and returned to the village alive and well. Everybody was pretty astonished.
Her uncle was also astonished, and today he's a social mobilizer active in the public education campaign against the virus. It's helped by UNICEF's efforts that revived 23 community radio stations and built 6 new ones. They emphasize efforts to prevent the spread of Ebola, like frequent hand washing, particularly in schools. Many people have stopped shaking hands, a widespread tradition in West Africa. Families are discouraged from touching sweat, urine, and other fluids from those infected, and to call an ambulance or pick up vehicle for the ill or diseased. At funerals, the family is also taught to refrain from touching the diseased. The bodies are sprayed with chlorine and put in white plastic bags for burial, white being the color traditionally associated with funerals among Muslims in Guinea. In Liberia, the bodies are often burned after the funeral. UNICEF says financial support is needed to continue supplies to rebuild health systems, to improve water and sanitation and education systems. Extended families who have taken in children will need cash transfers and other assistance. Health experts say that will depend on the continued support of the donors once the urgency of the crisis fades from the international media. For VOA, I'm Audit Fraser in Washington.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Good evening, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sport. As we begin the new year, Africa is about to reward her top-performing footballers, Football of the Year, Best Coach, Best Striker, and much more. VOA colleague Sunny Young sought out our African football guru, David Legg, and began by asking him for an update on this award.
Certainly, Sunny, and the big one, of course, is the African Footballer of the Year. That's the greatest individual honour that can be bestowed on any African footballer within Africa. Our older listeners will remember way back in 1995, we had that sensational year for Africa when George Weah from Liberia, he won not only the African Footballer of the Year, he also won the European Footballer of the Year and the World Footballer of the Year. But as far as awards in Africa are concerned, the African Footballer of the Year is the big one. We're down to the final three, Sonny, and no real surprises. It's Yaya Toure, who's bidding for an amazing fifth straight title. He's already got the record with four in a row. The previous record was Samuel Eto'o of Cameroon with three in a row, so that's been overtaken. And Yaya Toure, Sonny, he's threatening to just go down in history because it's going to be very difficult to match five in a row. But he's got to be the favourite. And he's up against Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, a person we mention almost weekly on the Sunny Side of Sport, because every week he seems to be banging in goals in Germany for Borussia Dortmund. And then André Ayew formerly played in France. He's now playing very well for Swansea in England. And, of course, he is one of the sons of the legendary Ghanaian Abede Pele. I've also had quite a few emails, Sonny, on the issue of Mahrez, the player who got the hat-trick just last weekend for Leicester City. And I think we've got to put him in the unlucky file. I think his recent form has been outstanding. But, of course, some of these selections were made just a little while ago. So I think the timing, he may have been a victim of that. But I think, Sonny, truthfully, I would have him in my top three with Aubameyang and Yaya Toure. I think Yaya Toure is the favourite, and my prediction is that Aubameyang will, for the second year in a row, will be the runner-up. But his turn will come if he keeps on banging in those goals. The second award, Sonny, is the Africa-based Football of the Year. A complaint in the past has been because most, if not all, of the top African footballers are actually playing overseas, that the Africa-based stars were being ignored. To rectify this problem, they brought in this Africa-based award. And I guess, again, not surprisingly, two of the three finalists are coming from TP Mazembe of the Democratic Republic of Congo. They are, of course, the winners this year of the CAF Champions League. One is the veteran goalkeeper, Robert Kidiaba. He's now 39 years of age, and he is, of course, famous for the bouncing bottom goal celebration. Initially was well known to Africans, and then in 2010 became known worldwide when he did it during the FIFA Club World Cup. The other Mazembe player is Mbwana Samata. He is a Tanzanian, and he was the joint leading scorer this year in the Champions League. The third finalist is Baghdad Bounedjad. He is an Algerian. He plays for Etoile Sahel of Tunisia. And it was his goal that played a key role in Etoile Sahel winning the CAF Confederation Cup this year. I see it, Sonny, as a straight fight between Samata and Kidiaba. I think sentiment might sway it towards Kidiaba, but on pure form, I think Samata would be a deserving winner of that award. We turn then to the team award, and here it's really interesting because of the five selections, three are underage teams. You've got the Mali under-17 team, you've got the Nigeria under-17 team. A reminder that they were the teams that fought it out for the FIFA under-17 World Cup, Nigeria winning 2-0. You've then got the Nigerian under-23 team, bronze medalists at the African Games in Congo-Brazzaville, and much more recently, the winners of the Olympic Games qualifying tournament in Senegal. Then, again, predictably, you've got the Ivory Coast and Ghana senior teams. They are the two countries who contested the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations final, Ivory Coast winning after extra time in a penalty shootout. So you have to say, Sonny, when it comes to the team award, very deserving finalists, and it's going to be difficult to decide there. We've also got five contenders for the coach of the year. You've got the two under-17 FIFA World Cup coaches, Emmanuel Amuneke of Nigeria and Baye Ba of Mali. You've got Fawzi Benzati, he's the veteran Tunisian who guided Etoile Sahel to the Confederation Cup title. You've got Herve Renard, a Frenchman, the only person to guide two different countries to the Africa Cup of Nations title. He did it in 2012 with Zambia, and he did it this year with the Ivory Coast. And another Frenchman in contention, Patrice Carteron, he guided Mazembe to the 2015 CAF Champions League title. So keen competition there as well. You also suddenly have an award called the Most Promising Prospects. And among the five finalists are Ferhat of Algeria, a man we mentioned an awful lot, Rabah of Egypt. You've also got Diarra of Mali. But sadly, in my opinion, no place for Farouk Mia of Uganda. And I'm just wondering if he's suffering because he's not one of the big countries of African football. My case for Mia is as follows. He scored three of the four goals in a World Cup qualifier against Togo. At the age of 17, he captained the Ugandan senior national team, and he's now 18 years of age. I think he's an outstanding prospect. And while I'm not saying he deserves to win the award, I would have liked to have seen him among the five finalists. You know, East African football, it needs all the encouragement it can get. It is the Cinderella region in the continent. I certainly think in the years to come, we're going to hear a lot more about Farouk Mia, who plays for the Vipers Club in Uganda. But I'm wondering just how much longer he'll be with them before he's whisked off to some European team. So that, Sonny, is a summary of the CAF Awards. The awards ceremony itself will be held in early January in Abuja, the capital of Nigeria.
That was our African football guru, David Legg, speaking from Johannesburg, South Africa, with my colleague Sunny Young. And as you just heard, the award ceremony will be held in Abuja this week on Thursday, January 7th. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. Enjoy.
Cause our land is honey, all the future money, and see na, see Akijima, no, no I see Lali, see Aksandi Mali, they want it, yo, they need it, I man, we have it, yes, let the world come and taste this beautiful land, they want it, oh, they need it, yeah, we have it, let the world come and taste this beautiful land,
oh.
Sisters and your brothers and your friends, let's get together, let's hold hands and let us dance. Let's unite and give ourselves another chance.
I see the waka for all the good things, many things, everything the apple pick the jolly. Oh yeah, now let Africa be good.
And in the sun or the rain or the sleet or the fame, we still be here together because
let Africa be good.
Oh, Nelson Mandela, Lupita Nyong'o.
Africa,
Barack Obama, Kwame Nkrumah, all my freedom fighters. We're taking off the handcuffs. We came to spread love through the sea breeze. Natural, Mama Africa, we need peace. Home sweet home, everybody will feel free. Check my people and check the beauty. Be my duty. They're trying to make it a better place for us, and I believe it's gonna happen in God we trust. Straight from the bottom all the way up to top. I prophesy it shall come to pass. Amen. From dust to grass, from grass to grace, but it's left to us to make it happen on a daily basis. Back to back, Africa stand for peace. Let's face the fact. Asante nyerere baba, wakuna jivunia, upendo wetu na amani. Tena pia, Mugabe bendera baba, wakuna jivunia, upendo wetu na amani. Tumejali mengi, kutelo mengi, omajengi melema mbuga pampita yetu. Tasoma mengi, kutelo mengi, omita melema mbuga pampita yetu.
Up up on the beat, oh. If your body na elele, my body na wire. If my body na elele, I be the one you require. Oh yeah, elele for me, dance for me. Let them know say that you happy for this. Elele for me, dance for me. Let them know say your body elele. Oh elele, oh elele. If your body na wire, I go be your supplier. If your body na wire, then I go be your supplier. Hello, Mr. Wire. Wire. What is your heart desire? Wire. I'm ready to flex. What is your name? Me, I be a man, Naira. There is no need to holla. I no come for your Naira. Just L.A. for me, L.A. for me. Then I will be your supplier. If your body go, then my body go. It go be like Medigo. Oh, baby, what I go? If your body go, then my body go. If your body na elele, my body na wire. If my body na elele, I be the one you require. Oh yeah, elele for me, dance for me. Let them know say that you happy for this. Elele for me, dance for me. Let them know say your body elele. Oh ole, oh. If your body na wire, I could be your supplier. If your body na wire, then I go be your supplier.
If your body na elele, eh, oh they got me wah wah wah, eh, bring it back up over, yeah yeah yeah, and it's getting bigger every yeah yeah yeah. Oh yeah, shake down, baby girl, like I wanna take chance, put your love in, break dance, I'll take it to the break dance. Girl, you give me oxygen, you don't need no apology.
We hope you enjoyed our Sunday music spot. A special greetings to Kwabena Kalala at Gassem in the Ghanaian capital, Accra. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. In the new year, the president of Burundi, Pierre Nkurunziza, has thrown down the gauntlet of defiance and vowed that his country would fight against any deployment of African Union's troops in his country. Is he bluffing or is he making some shrewd calculations? Knowing full well how heads of state of Africa behave, could he believe that no summit of the African Union could authorize the Peace and Security Council to deploy a force in Burundi against the wishes of the government? Perhaps he may be right. But then we have to turn to the Security Council. The president and his advisors may also believe that it is not possible for all the permanent members of the Security Council to agree to authorize African Union's troops to be deployed in Burundi. Burundi against the wishes of the government. This would be a sad reality if he is correct. And we should not forget what happened in 1994 when the failure of the Security Council to act as well as principal powers, we had a tragedy in Rwanda. What is now required is for the Security Council to make a finding under Article 39 of the Charter that the situation in Burundi represents a threat or a breach of international peace and security, and then authorize, in the first instance, strong sanction against the authorities in Burundi. If that fails, the Council can then request the African Union troops to act on its behalf by taking enforcement measures. The confusion we have had in the past few weeks is that much of the talk is about a peacekeeping force. The government is correct in saying that you cannot deploy peacekeeping force unless you have the consent of the government of Burundi. So what is being proposed is that the Council act under Chapter 7 of the Charter, which would mean an enforcement force, a force which the government of Burundi cannot reject, because the government of Burundi is obligated, as all member states under Article 25 of the Charter, to comply with such decisions of the Security Council. This is where the Security Council should move. We do not require a statement by the Council supporting the African Union. A statement of the Security Council does not have the same legal authority as specific resolution under Chapter 7. It would be regrettable if the Security Council, as it has done in the past, practiced double standards when it is willing to take forceful action when the issues involved is not in Africa but outside of Africa. It has in the past called on so-called coalition of the willing to take military action. Of course, in these instances, it has been NATO that has acted in the past. In the 50s, the Security Council authorized military force against the aggression of North Korea, and the U.S. was designated to do it. So this is a time of decision for the Security Council. President Museveni of Uganda, who is now leading negotiations with the parties in Burundi, made a very interesting statement last week. He observed that African governments are always willing to oppose any action by African institutions, but are willing to accept decisions made by other parts outside of Africa. Stay tuned to determine whether President Museveni is correct or not. I thank you.
That was one man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Saleh, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Cornelius, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, if the rhythm of the drum beat changes, the dance steps must adapt. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
December 18th, the United Nations unanimously approved Resolution 2254, which is to serve as a roadmap toward peace in Syria. By approving Resolution 2254 today, this council is sending a clear message to all concerned that the time is now to stop the killing in Syria and lay the groundwork for a government that the long-suffering people of that battered land can support, said Secretary of State John Kerry. After 4.5 years of war, this is the first time we have been able to come together at the United Nations in the Security Council to embrace a road forward. Resolution 2254 reaffirms the Council's endorsement of the Geneva Communique of 2012 and a transitional governing body with full executive authority, establishes a timeline for a transition and an election, and the standards for that election, and calls for a nationwide ceasefire in Syria as soon as possible. Under UNSCR 2254, the purpose of negotiations under UN auspices, planned for January 2016, is to facilitate a transition within Syria to a credible, inclusive, non-sectarian governance within 6 months. The process would lead to the drafting of a new constitution and arrangements for an internationally supervised election within 18 months. The resolution also urged all members of the International Syria Support Group to use their influence to press actors on the ground to positively respond to requests for humanitarian access and, most importantly, for all to put an end to the daily horrendous attacks on civilians. The key, said Secretary of State Kerry, is that the process must be led, shaped, decided, and implemented by the men and women of Syria. It cannot be imposed from the outside, and we are not seeking to do so, he said. We have agreed on a plan of action, and the Council's vote today is an important boost on the road to a political settlement. Let us proceed with confidence from here and a determination to end this war, eliminate the terrorist threat, and enable the people of Syria to return safely to their homes.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.